This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You have reached the edge of the world. Joseph Farrell is with us this week. Plus, at the end of the show, a very interesting poet, Laurel Erica, reads Acromega Metaphors. She is a magician with words and illustrates the power of words in this very intense poem about the nature of our political world. So in today's Dreamland, we're going to take our own unique view of politics first with one of the most extraordinary thinkers I have ever met, Joseph Farrell. And then for a few minutes, we're going to look into politics as it emerges out of words with Laurel Erica. Next week on Dreamland, Jay-Z Knight, the channeler of Ramtha. She's never been on Dreamland before, and it's going to be, I expect, a very interesting experience to listen to her explain to us exactly what she does and what it means after all of these years of work. During the past week on UnknownCountry.com, there were some very important stories. Most notable among them is a story about the disappearance of some radioactive isotopes in Kazakhstan. These isotopes couldn't be used to make a fissionable nuclear weapon, but they could be used to make a dirty bomb. I want to tell you something about dirty bombs. The radioactivity in them is not necessarily going to be persistent or even all that dangerous if you don't get too close to it. But the purpose of a dirty bomb is to spread panic and terror, which it certainly will do. Most people don't know how to protect themselves. They don't understand, and they will panic. They will think that the city that has received this blow is destroyed forever. In fact, however, it won't be true. The city will come back from a dirty bomb, not necessarily from a nuclear bomb, a fissionable nuclear bomb, but from a dirty bomb. How do you protect yourself in times like this? Well, Anne and I have got a 2-week supply of water. We have got freeze-dried food enough for 2 weeks as well. We have iodine tablets. We have weapons, not huge weapons, but minor weapons, but effective weapons in a desperate situation. And we have plenty of batteries. We have solar power, recharging devices. We have plenty of fuel to last if there's no gas. We have just about everything we need to survive in this apartment for 2 weeks. And that's what you should have. And I'm not selling anything. I'm not into selling survival equipment and being a professional on-air Cassandra at all. But I do think that you should look around, shop around, and prepare yourself if you live in a big city. The major targets in the United States are New York, Washington, Los Angeles, possibly Houston, secondarily San Francisco, and heartland cities that might be unexpectedly targeted since they are so difficult to reach. Also San Diego, because the naval base at San Diego is so important to supplying the naval resources that we have in the Middle East. So those places are all at risk in the United States. Obviously Paris, London, Berlin, all of the great cities of Europe, Rome in particular because of the presence of the Vatican, all of these cities are at risk as well. Now, in addition to the disappearance of the radioactive materials from Kazakhstan, at the same time, 12 passenger jets appear to have disappeared or been stolen in Libya. Now, there are a lot of reasons to steal a passenger plane, obviously. To get the parts into the parts stream, you can make millions and millions of dollars off of that. But you can also use that plane as a flying bomb. And when they were stolen, or apparently stolen, the idea that they could reach the United States was poo-pooed. This is not true. They can be, if they're 737s, refitted. The seats can be removed, the plane can be lightened up, and enough fuel can be put in it along with a relatively lightweight dirty bomb to reach the United States, at least the coast, the east coast of the United States. And of course, on the east coast, the primary target is Washington, D.C. So that's not out of the question. It is possible. These are times when we must be very wary about what is happening. And I would suggest something to you. What I do, I meditate. I meditate and I let all of this slip away and slip past me. And I find myself rising above the cares of the world every night. And it's immensely strengthening, empowering, and deeply healing. You can join the meditation group on unknowncountry.com. Just go to Whitley Space and click on meditation group. It's completely free. And it is updated every month, and the meditations in there are helpful. They're useful. They're meditations that, for the most part, I have used effectively for years. And I have now been meditating for, I can't believe it, more than 40 years. Ooh, time does fly. Now, when we come back, we're going to be talking to Joseph Farrell, then later, the wonderful Laurel Erica, with a very powerful and beautiful new and different look at the word energy that is behind the darkness of human politics.
Some of the most thrilling, mind-opening interviews ever recorded are in the Dreamland Archive. Open your mind to Sir Lawrence Gardner's brilliant vision of the past. Listen to Russell Targ's phenomenal insights about ESP. Be inspired by Dr. Eben Alexander's stunning near-death experience. Listen to an actual recording from a plane as it was attacked by a gigantic flying disc. Be transported to a new level of inner grace with Whitley Strieber's meditations. Enjoy The Communion, Transformation, Majestic, Secret School, and Superstorm audiobooks, and so much more. The UnknownCountry.com subscriber section. $3.95 a month to $79 for 2 years. As little as 10 cents a day. Priceless.
In the subscriber area this week, we have one of the most fascinating programs that we have ever aired. Joseph Farrell on all kinds of things he rarely discusses, such as the mysterious Voynich manuscript. What is it? Where did it come from? Why hasn't it been deciphered, or has it been deciphered? And the Oak Island mystery. Do you know Oak Island off the coast of Newfoundland, a little island that has a strange structure underneath it, that it's partly in the water? No one has ever been able to get to the bottom of this structure. Who built it? How? And why? Who was building such an incredibly sophisticated underground and underwater structure hundreds or thousands of years ago? This is a really fascinating interview with one of the most remarkable people in the world. Now, that said, I can't go on much longer unless you subscribe. You've got to do it because I'm reaching the end of my rope. I'll be frank with you. I have to have you on board. Please subscribe to UnknownCountry.com. Do it today.
Well, today we have with us one of Dreamland's most popular and most requested guests. Incredibly, I discovered that Joseph had not been with us since October of 2013. That is nearly a year ago, and since 2006, we have never gone more than 6 months without Joseph Farrell on this radio program. I consider Joseph to be one of the most interesting, well-informed people in the world and one of the smartest. He sees right through an awful lot of stuff, His website is GizaDeathStar.com. Joseph, welcome back. Welcome home.
Well, thank you, Whitley. Thanks for having me back. Pleasure to be here.
When I circularized my subscribers as to who they would most like to hear next on Dreamland, your name was way up at the top of the list. Where is Joseph? So I'm very glad to have you back with us. Now, you know, I think where I'd like to start is sort of way back at the beginning. Why is your website called Giza Death Star?
Well, it's named after the first three books that I did in kind of this alternative research publishing stint that I've been on, the Giza Death Star trilogy, which are three books basically about my hypothesis that the Great Pyramid may have been some sort of advanced type of machine, a weapon system of some sort involving very avant-garde sorts of physics. And things just kind of took off from there, and when I decided to go into the website part of this, I decided I might as well name it after the most controversial aspect.
It was a little controversial. I remember that quite well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the time, we, and incidentally, subscribers, you can listen to the whole massive Joseph Farrell body of work in our archive. We have got a lot of programming dating back to 2006, and it ranges from the extraordinary to the truly extraordinary.
Yeah.
Okay, now let's start this time today, though, mm-hmm. with the an interestingly titled book, Thrice Great Hermetica, and the Janus Age. Now, I want to start with, we're going to be talking, folks, just so you know, about remarkable stories regarding Venice, the Templars, and what do they have in common, the Holy Land, secret excavations there, the pontificate of Pope Innocent III, one of the more sinister popes. I mean, has there ever been a pope who wasn't sinister?
but he didn't qualify in that category.
Maybe Pope Joan?
Yeah.
Anyway, we're going to be getting into this in just a moment. Where I would like to start with it, mm-hmm. if you don't mind, mm-hmm. is to get into the meaning of the phrase, the Janus Age.
Well, I chose that very deliberately, Whitley, because the way I look at it, I used to be a medieval history professor in college, and this is kind of the book I wanted to write when I was a medieval history professor, but I didn't dare, because it's so outside of the academic bailiwick. My approach throughout the book is to assume that conspiracies are nothing new. And the Middle Ages is full of them. So, to a certain extent, I chose that phrase to indicate that we are dealing not just merely with the surface sort of academic recitation of dates and times and kings and popes and emperors, but to look beneath the surface and to inquire why they're doing the things they're doing. Is there some big plan? And, of course, once you say that, then you're looking square at the Templars right in the eyes, because they form such a high, crucial component during the High Middle Ages. The second reason is that the Middle Ages, whether we like it or not, the Middle Ages saw the beginning, really, of institutions that we take for granted. It saw the beginning of banking in the modern sense that we take for granted. It saw the beginning of commodities markets. It saw the beginning of the corporation. It saw the beginning of modern jurisprudence that we're familiar with. The nation state in a great degree becomes a creation of the Middle Ages. So the Middle Ages look forward to the contemporary period. But at the end of the Middle Ages and on into the High Renaissance, which is also a part of the book, and even into the early Enlightenment, with this explosion of hermetic and alchemical and Kabbalistic doctrines that you have in the northern Italian city-states, you're also looking back through centuries, quite literally, to classical civilizations and to their doctrines and to their revivals. So it's a Janus Age in that sense as well, as looking forward and as looking back. So I employed the phrase to indicate a bit of that. And I tell people, and I mean it quite literally, this is a messy book because I'm trying to do a little bit of conspiracy theory, look at the Middle Ages. I'm trying to do an exploration of the influence of Hermetic doctrines on the movement, the hidden movements of the Middle Ages, and then as they burst out into the open during the Renaissance. And I'm also looking back to the influence of those doctrines on the Templars and their activities and what they may have really been looking for. So it's a messy book. It's kind of all over the board. I even do a bit of music theory in it. So, that tells you how messy it is.
I would like to go back, if we may, mm-hmm. to the Caribbean and mm-hmm. to some of the secret voyages. But before we do that, folks, sure. we'll, for those of you who aren't subscribers, we'll be right back eventually. For the subscribers, we'll go straight on.
Some of the most thrilling, mind-opening interviews ever recorded are in the Dreamland Archive. Open your mind to Sir Lawrence Gardner's brilliant vision of the past. Listen to Russell Targ's phenomenal insights about ESP. Be inspired by Dr. Eben Alexander's stunning near-death experience. Listen to an actual recording from a plane as it was attacked by a gigantic flying disc. Be transported to a new level of inner grace with Whitley Strieber's Meditations. Enjoy The Communion, Transformation, Majestic, Secret School, and Superstorm audiobooks, and so much more. The UnknownCountry.com subscriber section. $3.95 a month to $79 for 2 years. As little as 10 cents a day. Priceless.
In the subscriber area this week, we have one of the most fascinating programs that we have ever aired. Joseph Farrell on all kinds of things he rarely discusses, such as the mysterious Voynich manuscript. What is it? Where did it come from? Why hasn't it been deciphered, or has it been deciphered? And the Oak Island mystery. Do you know Oak Island off the coast of Newfoundland, a little island that has a strange structure underneath it that's partly in the water? No one has ever been able to get to the bottom of this structure. Who built it? How? And why? Who was building such an incredibly sophisticated underground and underwater structure hundreds or thousands of years ago? This is a really fascinating interview with one of the most remarkable people in the world. Now, that said, I can't go on much longer unless you subscribe. You've got to do it because I'm reaching the end of my rope. I'll be frank with you. I have to have you on board. Please subscribe to UnknownCountry.com. Do it today.
Whitley and Ann Strieber's new book, Miraculous Journey, is well on its way to becoming a bestseller. One reader after another has found hope and inspiration in the pages of this deeply moving book, which has over 20 five-star reviews on Amazon.com. From reader Martin Taylor, a book to savor. Like much of the Strieber's work, this is a very moving read, and I find myself smiling as much as holding back tears. From Melissa Latimer, this is a beautiful, hopeful story of the power of love in the face of life-changing health problems. From Raven Dana, this book is moving, instructive, and most of all, a beautiful testament to the power of love. From Catherine Cook, the authors guide us through their dark night of the soul with beautiful prose and truly inspiring insights that leave the reader feeling hope and joy. Reader after reader has taken Miraculous Journey into their heart, and you will too.
And Miraculous Journey is now available in hardcover and softcover on Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com and in electronic format wherever ebooks are sold. Get a copy today. You won't be sorry. This has been a life-changing book for me and Anne, and I believe it will be for you, too. Get a copy today. Don't pass it by. This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking to Joseph Farrell. His website, GizaDeathStar.com. Right now, we're talking about Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age. And one of the most interesting things about the Caribbean during the Golden Age of piracy was that the first pirates appeared in longboats and flying the Templar battle flag, which became known as the Jolly Roger.
Right.
Could you tell us about a little bit about some of these secret voyages? And I might add, let's bring up as well the fact that let's just start there. There's so much to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
I hope we can get finished in the 14 to 15 hours we have.
Well, it may take that long. The secret voyages aspect of the Middle Ages, Whitley, are the most fascinating because, as I try and detail in the book, there is no doubt that there is some sort of hidden, very secret activity, probably sponsored by the Templars, if not conducted directly by them, which I think is the case, of voyaging to the New World. And we have evidences of this, we have suggestions of this, with the Kennewick Knight, a figure in Massachusetts of a knight, on a rock, that is in full armor with carrying a Templar sword. So, you know, what's this doing in Massachusetts? All right.
Right.
We have indications like this. There is a significant story here, and that is the hidden, it's not really hidden, it was a given geopolitical fact during the Middle Ages, but it's become more or less obscured by modern academic approaches to history, and that is the alliance between the military crusading orders like the Templars and Hospitallers and the northern Italian city-states, namely Venice and Genoa in particular. The Templars were very closely allied with Venice, and the reason is, it goes back to the Fourth Crusade, and I lay all this out in the book, when you have the statement that six French knights show up in Venice at the Doge's palace, at the time that was Enrico Dandolo, the famous blind Doge of Venice, negotiating for the transport of this large crusading army to, supposedly, ostensibly, to the Middle East. And right there, that's a clue, because, of course, French knights should tell you something. It should tell you that there's a Templar connection going on here. Now, in most academic studies, in most academic textbooks, you're not going to get that sort of read on things, but the fact of the matter is, history shows us that the Fourth Crusade was diverted to, ostensibly diverted, I think it was intended to end up at Constantinople from the outset. That's another argument I'm making in the book. But we know that Templars were along because the Podesta, the Venetian Podesta that was installed after the sacking of Constantinople, was a fellow by the name of Marin Zeno, and that should really set off alarm bells right there. And we'll get to that part of the story in a moment. Zeno was installed as the Venetian Podesta, and after the Venetian Republic had more or less taken control of the northern part of the Byzantine Empire and the northern part of the Bosporus, they sent word to Pope Innocent III, a fellow by the name of Lotario Cardinal de Conti, and the man carrying this letter to the Pope, was in fact a Templar knight. So in other words, we have the presence of the Templars shortly after the Crusade had sacked Constantinople, and that to me is a huge clue. So there's this geopolitical given throughout that period of the Middle Ages that when you said Templars, you were also thinking of their allies, the Venetians. And one of the things I'm arguing in the books that they were looking for when they sacked Constantinople was hidden knowledge, and in particular, hidden cartographic knowledge that most likely came to Constantinople via Alexandria during that period prior to the 7th century that the Byzantine Empire actually ruled Egypt. So I think they uncovered this secret cartographic tradition because it is precisely after the Fourth Crusade that you begin to see these indications that there are some sort of contacts between Western Europe and North America that are being kept a very, very closely held secret. And I suspect that the reason why, Whitley, is because this was perceived as a source of bullion, which, of course, Venice would have wanted to keep very, very secret, as well as the Templars. There's another aspect of this story, and that goes to the celebrated Zeno manuscript. And let me preface what I'm going to say here that is very important. There are attempts within the academic community, and have been since this manuscript first appeared in the middle of the 16th century in London, to denounce the whole manuscript as a hoax. And these academic criticisms of the manuscript, they're very plausibly well argued. But their standard approach is academic. In other words, they're forgetting that what we're dealing with here is, number one, a Templar order, which by the time of the Zeno voyages has already been disbanded, supposedly, and is defunct. And we also have to remember that with Venice, we're dealing with probably the most studied and practiced nation-state in Western Europe at the time, in the fine arts and crafts of covert operations and intelligence, okay? So in other words, I think that in order to study this period, you literally have to take off the academic blinders and start being willing to speculate and read between the lines. Now, the Zeno manuscript purports to be a manuscript of a voyage undertaken by Niccolo and Antonio Zeno to Venetians, to the northern islands of the British Isles, the Orkney Islands and the Faroe Islands and so on. And there, according to the manuscript, they meet up with a prince who ultimately, if you read the defenders of the manuscript, turns out to be Prince Henry Sinclair, all right? And that will ring a bell for those who followed the Templar story, because the Sinclair family are alleged to have very close ties to the Templars.
I want to just jump in here very quickly. Lord John Pentland, who was the head of the Gurdjieff Foundation in the 70s and 80s,
right,
was a descendant of John Sinclair.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, the present John Sinclair, who is his son and is the head of the Gurdjieff Foundation in New York, is also a descendant of the same man.
Right. Well, this again is to me an indicator that you have a very tight association of that particular family.
Yes.
With esoteric doctrines and systems and with esoteric studies. And certainly hidden voyages to the New World are in that ballpark. And this is exactly what the manuscript maintains happened. That these two Venetian admirals, along with Henry Sinclair, actually undertook a voyage first to Greenland and then to North America. Now, that may seem an extravagant claim, because these claims are being made that this voyage occurred in the year 1398, almost a century before the voyage of Columbus.
And yet, look at Rosalind Chapel, look at the cornstalks.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. There are these indicators that there is some sort of contact secretly taking place. Well, the question is, why would we have Venetians involved with this? And the way I try and lay it out in the book, Whitley, is that they, along with their Templar allies, probably because of the sack of Constantinople and the recovery of some hidden cartographic tradition that begins to circulate very quietly and secretly throughout Western Europe, Genoan, the Hospitallers, the Templars, and so on, are conducting these secret voyages and bringing back with them bullion. Because it's specifically and explicitly mentioned in the Zeno manuscript that the North American Indians that they come into contact with are in possession of large amounts of gold. And of course, gold is one of the staples of international commerce and finance at that time. So
yeah,
Venice,
it was a foundation of all power. Really.
Absolutely. And Venice, of course, was the European bullion market at the time. So this was a hidden secret supply of bullion for the people involved in banking. And the way I lay it out in the book is that the Zeno manuscript probably, since you have the same family involved, as was the name of the family of the first Phoenician governor of post-Fourth Crusade Constantinople, that in all likelihood what happened was that they recovered this and made it, so to speak, a family patrimony of that oligarchical family within the Venetian Republic. And moreover, it's very interesting in the manuscript that the Zenos that are on this voyage are described as cavalieri. In other words, they're described as knights. So again, why would they be described this way? Well, in the book, I go back and I go to the Albigensian Crusade and then ultimately to the destruction and demise of the Templar Order under King Philippe le Bel in France in the year 1307. And it's very interesting, Whitley, because if you look at that and look at what happens in Venice 3 years later, in Venice you have the founding of the Council of Ten in the year 1310. And the way I look at it is you have to connect these two things, because what do the Templars really constitute as far as Venice is concerned in their relationship with Venice? Well, they're the international arm. They're the international intelligence aspect of Venice's contacts prior to the demise of the Templars. So when they found the Council of Ten, what I really suspect they've done is they're founding, first of all, the replacement intelligence agency, which is what the Council of Ten really was. And they're doing this also as a potential point of refuge for Templar knights within Italy to seek a haven where their talents and resources will be continued to be used, and used in a direct fashion by the Venetian state. So these things, in my opinion, Whitley, these things have to be looked at as part of a whole big, huge, complex political operation. The demise of the Templars, the Albigensian Crusade, the founding of the Council of Ten, the secret voyages, and so on.
That had also an inner life. In other words, it journeyed into the world of the soul.
Yes.
Very definitely. We're going to talk more about this when we get back. We'll be right back.
Whitley and Ann Streber's new book, Miraculous Journey, is well on its way to becoming a bestseller. One reader after another has found hope and inspiration in the pages of this deeply moving book, which has over 20 five-star reviews on Amazon.com. From reader Martin Taylor, a book to savor. Like much of the Streber's work, this is a very moving read, and I find myself smiling as much as holding back tears. From Melissa Latimer, this is a beautiful, hopeful story of the power of love in the face of life-changing health problems. From Raven Dana, this book is moving, instructive, and most of all, a beautiful testament to the power of love. From Catherine Cook, the authors guide us through their dark night of the soul with beautiful prose and truly inspiring insights that leave the reader feeling hope and joy. Reader after reader has taken Miraculous Journey into their heart. And you will too.
And Miraculous Journey is now available in hardcover and softcover on Barnes & Noble and Amazon.com and in electronic format wherever ebooks are sold. Get a copy today. You won't be sorry. This has been a life-changing book for me and Anne, and I believe it will be for you too. Get a copy today. Don't pass it by. This is Whitley Strieber. We're talking to Joseph Farrell. We're going to have a fascinating extension of this conversation in the subscriber area. We're going to be talking about things like the Voynich manuscript. Joseph's got some very interesting things to say about it. I've always wanted to ask him his thoughts about it. We'll do that later, Joseph. But also, the skull and crossbones, which a Masonic scholar, P.D. Newman, has identified as being a legitimate Masonic symbol.
Yes.
As well, and what it means, what that symbol means, and why it is, and what the dead head was of the Templars. Now, but before we go in that direction, let's go back to medieval Europe to Venice and to these journeys that began to take place between the old and new worlds led by John Sinclair. And, you know, they get me deeply, and I'll tell you why. I think there is, first of all, a very much of an intact Masonic Templar movement in Canada.
Yes.
Then they do have a lot of esoteric knowledge.
Yes.
And I can never forget that extraordinary man, the Master of the Key, who was so richly knowledgeable, said to me, "I'm a Canadian, but I don't pay taxes," implying that he was a Canadian from before Canada existed, and his family had simply never registered itself.
Right.
And I think of the Mi'kmaq Indians. And
oh, yes.
So tell us a little bit about the Mi'kmaqs.
Well, the Mi'kmaqs figure extremely prominently in the Zeno manuscript, although they are not named as such. But it's very clear, a scholar by the name of Frederick J. Pohl, P-O-H-L, wrote a study of the Zeno manuscript and compared its assertions with the claims of the Mi'kmaq legends. And the Mi'kmaq peoples preserved several statements that find their way into Pohl's book. One of them is, first of all, that they were in contact with white people from across the ocean. And when the Zenos and Henry Sinclair show up and meet these people, most likely in some place in Nova Scotia, the extraordinary thing that they discover is that the chief that they encounter, the local tribal chief of the Mi'kmaq Nation, had in his possession books in his library in Latin. So, in other words, there had been some contact even before that. And again, we go back to the fact that, you know, you've got the Kennewick Knight there in Massachusetts of this very faintly carved figure in full armor, you know,
right.
Very clearly a European knight of some sort with a Templar-looking blade. So they clearly had some contact. And the other thing that the manuscript points out is that the Mi'kmaqs not only had preserved these legends of contact with white Europeans, but and these extraordinarily Latin books in their libraries, but that they also were in possession of large amounts of gold. And of course, once you say that again, you're saying that there's a financial interest in these voyages. And in my opinion, they were probably bringing back bullion in some form or another through trade with the Indians and secretly using that as a hidden source or a hidden reserve to what was going on in Venice at the time in the commodities market. So it's a huge story. The Mi'kmaqs are definitely a part of this whole tradition. And you're absolutely correct. The Canadians do appear to have some sort of Masonic Templar distinction in their version of Masonry. But I want to address something else that you've raised, and that's the Jolly Roger, the skull and crossbones flag. Because I point out at the Council of Vienne in France, not Vienna, the people often get the two confused, but this was a council that took place in a little French village of Vienne that actually was the council that formally disbanded the Templars, and then this was later certified by Pope Clement V. And the interesting thing in this council, Whitley, is that the council decreed that absolutely, for all time, no Templar insignia whatsoever could be publicly displayed. This included Jolly Rogers. This included also the familiar Templar corporate logo, so to speak, of the Red Cross on the white background. And yet, when we get to Columbus is sailing with the Niña and the Pinta and the Santa Maria with big red crosses boldly emblazoned on the white sails.
Right.
So, you know, again, there's a very clear, bold, symbolic proclamation that we're doing this under the aegis of something more than just King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. And when you add this to the fact that in the Spanish capitulations that were signed between Columbus and the two Spanish monarchs, when the signing was done, Queen Isabella made a very, very significant statement to Columbus, apparently. And the statement was to the effect that, sir, it would seem that you know a great deal more about these worlds than, and her implication was, than was possible with just guesswork or reading. In other words, she was implying that he had actually probably undertaken some secret voyages to the New World before, even on his own.
Fascinating. Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, it gets even more fascinating, Whitley, because on the tomb of Pope Innocent VIII, Giovanni Cardinal Cibo, who was actually a Genoan like Columbus, Giovanni Cibo, on his tomb in Rome, you can see Columbus's esoteric signature boldly stamped on the Pope's tomb. And the question is why?
Yeah.
Well, interestingly enough, I ran in my researches into a wonderful Italian scholar by the name of Ruggiero Marino, and I kind of review his work in the book. And Marino comes to the conclusion that Columbus may have been one of the Pope's many children. And now here's the really interesting thing about this. When Cardinal Cibo was in the conclave that eventually elected him Pope, his other opponent was described as a knight, as was Cibo. So in other words, both papal candidates in that conclave that eventually elected him to be Pope Innocent VIII were apparently members of the crusading military orders, but we're not told which ones. We only know that they were described as knights. Now, I know that may seem like I'm stretching a point here, but people have to remember what a knight represented back during that period of time. A knight was a complex, very expensive military technology. In other words, you had to have a kind of military industrial complex behind you to make your armor, to stall your horses, to take your squires into battle to prepare you with the armor and everything. So it was a very complex military technology that required financing. This is why the crusading orders arose in the first place. You had to create a kind of transnational European-wide military industrial complex. That's really what they were. And Cibo, of course, represents one of these. We don't know what, but interestingly enough, Cibo was not only described as a knight, he was a nephew of a Muslim, he had Jewish blood, and of course he was a Christian. So in other words, he is kind of a prophetic fulfillment to stage the announcement of the New World. And of course, Columbus coming from Genoa, we have Ferdinand and Isabella with their connections to the Genoese bankers, to the De Medicis in Florence. So there's something going on here beyond just Ferdinand and Isabella, you know, backing a crazy scheme to go find the New World. I think really what you have is Ferdinand and Isabella and Columbus are kind of the public fronts for a very old agenda that's being driven by these military crusading orders that already know all about it. So I told you this was a messy book.
Yeah, well, it is a bit, but at the same time, this kind of knowledge is foundational.
Yes.
If you understand this, you understand the flow of money and the flow of power right up to and including organizations like the Trilateral Commission.
Yes.
You do.
Yes.
And when we continue, we're going to get into some of the deep secrets that are involved here, because after all, we're talking about a time now when the Templars were at the pinnacle of power.
Oh, yes.
But something happened. Something happened, folks, and they lost that position very terribly and very dramatically. Joseph Farrell knows why, and he knows a lot about the flow of energy, the flow of dark and light energy in this world, as it is expressed in directly in our lives through these hidden forces. Joseph's new book is Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age. Joseph, what can we expect next?
Well, I'm doing another book with my co-author on transhumanism, Scott DeHart, and I'm doing another couple of books. I eventually want to kind of finish out this Bankster series, and I do very deliberately think of Thrice Great Hermetica and the Janus Age as kind of a sequel to Babylon's Banksters and Financial Vipers of Venice. And eventually I want to do some things on the connection between consciousness and physics and so on and so forth. So I've got a lot planned. Lord willing, I'll get around to them.
You know what I would love to do? I would love to have you and Catherine Austin Fitz on together.
Oh, sure.
That would be fascinating. Folks, we're going to do that in the fall. Catherine's never been on the show, and she wants to come on, I'm happy to say, and we will be having her on soon, and hopefully Joseph will join us. Joseph's website is GizaDeathStar.com, and you know, you can become a subscriber. And Joseph, can you tell us just why we should do that? Because I think it's important.
Well, in the subscriber area, I have a number of papers that I don't make generally public. They're not very many, but they're on some very, very bizarre topics. I'm planning to do, if I can get the technology to work, a bunch of just kind of video monologues. I have video interviews with my web developer there on various topics of contemporary moment, geopolitics, esotericism, physics, things of that sort. And then every 2 weeks, I do a members' vid chat on usually on Fridays with my members. They submit questions to me, and I do my best to try and answer them or comment on them. We have a lot of fun, actually. I spend several hours with them, just kind of exchanging ideas and batting things around. It's a lot of fun.
And it's a fascinating group of people, and I might add that those papers, they're worth reading, and you're not going to expect what you find. So, Giza Death Star, do take a look at it, and definitely pick up Joseph's latest book. It is obviously well worth your time. Next up, Laurel Erica. This is going to be interesting. I'd love to hear your comments about her work and this particular poem. It's very, very interesting stuff. You find the power of words in this work, and it's unusual. You don't often find people who understand this. You ever been curious about aliens and the underground? My new novel, Alien Hunter Underworld, the second in the series, but it's a standalone. You don't have to have read the first novel to enjoy the second, is about that very subject, and it looks into it in a completely new way. What's really going on under there? Could it be something much more extraordinary than any of us have ever imagined? Well, I let my imagination loose when I write fiction, because I think it goes deep inside me into places that I can't reach any other way. I think what appeared in this novel will amaze you, as it has me. Get Alien Hunter Underworld at your local bookstore in hardcover, as an ebook, as an audiobook from audible.com. If you like it, why not go on Amazon and give me a review? I would be so grateful. And if you're one of the subscribers who got one of the 50 free signed copies, well, I hope you go on and give it a review too, and I hope you enjoy the book, Alien Hunter Underworld. I'm so proud of it. Get it today. Laurel Erica is a Santa Monica-based freelance writer and an English language linguist who has spent a lifetime exploring the means by which the world is fashioned from the word. She has presented her word magic perspective in schools, universities, and on stage, and in the U.S. and the U.K. Her website is www.laurelerica.com. That's L-A-U-R-E-L-A-I-R-I-C-A. L-A-U-R-E-L-A-I-R-I-C-A.com. And here she is reading Macromega Metaphors.
You've likely never heard before of a macromega metaphor, but that's a pun that helps one see the drama and absurdity of what we often take to be our bottom line reality. Since a major source of human friction, responsible for great affliction, is the arrogance with which most cultures designate what's fact or fiction, we might then very well expect, because our words and worlds connect, some state to state with ardent zeal that it alone on earth is real. And since its people Israelite, they wrote the book on wrong and right. We've believed now for millennia in some cosmic schizophrenia that bifurcates the universe, such that the righteous and perverse have separate realms on which they dwell, with earth the battleground where hell and heaven's denizens fight for our guilt or innocence, while we, with nothing much to lose except our souls, are forced to choose twixt God or mammon, feast or famine, so well disguised we must examine deep within our heart of hearts to see these worlds are worlds apart. And because our lives are metaphors for our beliefs, we cannot ignore how cosmic conflict finds expression upon this plane through a succession of wars and pandemonium, where Tweedledee fights Tweedledum. Each certain God is on his side, encouraging the fratricide. This purview helps us understand why the Irish live in Ireland, why the Romans roamed, why the French have Gaul, and why it is U.S. is against you all. It's why imperialists have said for eons to conquered peoples, now European. And why Hades, as all will agree, in its singular form, is pronounced Haiti. Such unseen clues can make it seem we're sleeping through a waking dream, since many words and names we find are symbols for our states of mind. But since most folks raise such strong objections to the thought that archetypes might have sound connections, there are few who register humor or shock to hear the world sex capital called Bangkok. And wait, it gets even better. When I looked up Bangkok in the dictionary, it was defined as a small port for seamen and the capital of Thailand. Of course, the H is silent. And speaking of the world's sex capital, or sexting from the capital, is it anything but poetic justice that the lawmaker who couldn't keep it zipped was named Wiener? What a role to play. And actually, when we put enough puns together, it starts to look like we're all playing roles in a divine comedy, or else some kind of cosmic absurdity. And considering how close these are to each other, it makes sense that the only difference between the comic and the cosmic is the letter S. Recently, I learned that there's a township in County Cork, Ireland, called Kilbritton. It's spelled just as it sounds, yet it's not an English word. It's Irish and means Britain's church, which was imposed by bloody force upon the Irish by the British, hence Kilbritton. Now, how can we call this accidental when some puns provide a transcendental overview of correlations between our thoughts and our creations, while others are the secret pathwords pointing toward our liberation?
Our liberation. People like Joseph Farrell and Laurel Erica point to it in very different ways. Thank you so much for listening to Dreamland, and I do hope you are a subscriber to this radio program and to this website, because you help support us and you get to listen to Joseph's next section of the show, which is awesome. It is really well worth your time. And we are well worth your money.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and our family of subscribers. Our news editor is Ann Streber. Our science reporter is Linda Moulton Howe. Our webmaster is Daniel Stiegel. And I'm your Dreamland announcer, Brian Arnold. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.